Good morning. Boy, it's early. I'm tweeting live. Can't spell live. It's so damn early, and my coffee machine wasn't working. Well, it was out of water, so I got a coffee machine on an IoT switch. Now, I had IoT'd this switch well and truly before I was IoT'ing all the other things, and I'll talk about IoT'ing other things a little bit today as well. Yeah, it's an IoT switch, one of those little Wemo ones, comes on at like 4:30 in the morning so that the coffee machine is warm. Not the coffee that's warm. If you actually got some automated thing making coffee, it sits in one of those pots. That's terrible. Anyway, so coffee machine's got to be warm. But the problem is that it's got a pressure sensor on the water tank. And when the water tank gets down to a certain level, it automatically turns the thing off. Now, in the morning, coffee machine comes on and it sucks a bunch of water into the boilers to start warming everything up. Went down, cold coffee machine. I'm literally one mouthful into coffee at 6 a.m. Two mouthfuls. Now, it's going to be a little bit different this week because I didn't prepare much, but there was a bunch of sort of interesting stuff, particularly as a result of last week's update. So what I'm going to do, and also g'day to people chiming in. Thank you. I do see those comments from Norway in the UK. South Africa, Gordon. what type of coffee? So I have got an Expo Bar Minoir 4 is the coffee machine with a Kwama grinder. And then there's a roaster not too far from here that I really like. Really like the guy and the place. Fun story, the guy creates like arcade games out of Raspberry Pis. And then you sell like the whole arcade thing with a flat screen in it and classic controllers. And they all run off like Raspberry Pi, classic arcade stuff. So I go over there, have a look at that, get some coffee. So coffee, incidentally, for those of you who have not been to Australia, and if you haven't, I'm sorry, I don't know when you're going to get to come at this rate. But Australia has a massive coffee culture. And what's really interesting is a lot of people go, wow, I went to Australia and it was like the best coffee in the world. I never knew it was like this. And I've been to Italy and all these places, as have I. And frankly, I think it is actually amazing here. It's just Australia is a very kind of foodie place. All right, let me kick into sponsors. So sponsor this week, brand new sponsor. You may have heard of them before, a little place called Microsoft, which is nice to have Microsoft on board. The first time Microsoft has been a sponsor on this blog. More specifically, it's the Microsoft Reactor. And the Reactor is where they invest a whole bunch of time and resources and inevitably money in helping startups get their things built predominantly on the Microsoft stack. But, of course, the Microsoft stack these days is all sorts of bits and pieces and all sorts of open source bits and pieces as well. We'll talk about open source later on too. I have spent a lot of time at Microsoft Reactors around the world doing talks and things. And, so they are up here. Join the Microsoft Reactor community for workshops, panels, and events to expand your skill set across a range of technologies and topic areas. And it's... I just feel a little bit tearful thinking back to times that I have spent in the Microsoft Reactors. Now, because today is going to be super casual, I'm going to keep reading these comments as I go through. Hello from Venezuela. Oh, that's pretty awesome. I have not been to South America yet. I want to try and go to South America one day, one place I've not been. Been to New Zealand, and that's close, but I don't know when I'm going to get back there either. God, who knows? Thanks, Paul. Loved the coffee when he was here in Brisbane. Brisbane's about an hour up the road from me just here. And someone sent my session fixation video, which they liked. That brings back memories. That would have been a while ago. Crikey. So moving on, what I thought I'd do this week is kind of work backwards through my tweet stream, because effectively anything that was interesting is in there. And then as I go through, if you've got comments or questions about this or anything else, just drop them in there. But of course, the big thing, in fact, the big two things that have dominated my last week were the things that I discussed in last week's update. The first of them being the Nord strategic advisor relationship. And, you know, this is one of these things, and because I'd announced it the day before the last video, so I did most of it there and I won't recap on it all. It's one of these things where, you know, most of the feedback has been pretty positive, and it's mostly been along the lines of people recognize that Nord wants to invest in actually getting folks like myself to I guess, lend some ideas to the way they do things, the way they communicate, and the way their products are going as well. And even though there's a few things there in terms of particularly the marketing message, which I think have been a bit off key at times, there's a recognition that, okay, they want to try and work on that. And that is something that we've been doing even last week. So behind the scenes, there's particularly some styles of communicating the product efficacy, which I would suggest there are more effective ways of doing. So as we start to actually kick goals in that, I want to share it as well, because I don't want this thing to be an announcement and then you just disappear off into the black hole that is working behind the scenes. Like, I want stuff that is actually effective and visible to other people to show as a result of this relationship. So that is ticking along. But of course, the big thing, which is what I just announced in the update last week, was about open sourcing Have I Been Pwned. Now, this has been 99.99% positive. There's always going to be like that one little tiny fraction, which I expected, because open sourcing as a concept is something that makes people very happy. I also expected people would be very happy the idea of doing it with Have I Been Pwned, which is something which to me has always been a very community-centric tool. And by, I would say, equal parts good luck and good management, I don't want to take some credit here for it, but I certainly haven't planned it, a lot of good luck, the thing actually became popular. Now, part of that was my doing, but part of it was just very fortunate, right time, right place, and having the luxury to build a pet project whilst I could still do my job, and then later on I could be independent and do my other things. So I've been very fortunate with Have I Been Pwned. The open source stuff makes a lot of sense. That, I guess, where I'm at, just to embellish a bit more on last week as well, I said then I can't just sort of pick it up and go, just flick this repo to public and that's it, it's job done. There's a whole bunch of things, and just like randomly off the top of my head, one of them is the license. What should the open source license be? There are different sorts of licensing models. The intent is to make sure that everyone has access to code, everyone can contribute. I guess if you wanted to take a copy of Have I Been Pwned, you could, but frankly, you could do that at the moment anyway. So it's like Control U, Control A, Control C, Notepad, Control V. Hey, copy Have I Been Pwned. So there's that part of it. That's the intent. The execution is the tricky bit, because this has been a pet project for nearly 7 years now. And I have done a lot of dodgy shit with the way that I have written code and managed the thing over that period of time. And as I said in the blog post, I'm sure I've probably checked in secrets and things like that before, which is obviously an anti-pattern, particularly when you start opening up the source. So I need to go through that. And I really, my gut feel at the moment is I really want to modularize the whole thing in a way that I can just start to take bits and go, okay, this, let's say, for example, the public API that people go and pay their $3.50 a month for. Let's take this, put it over there, and this is a manageable scope of work which I can go through and be pretty confident the code doesn't have anything terrible with. It might go through a phase of having some folks that I know and trust and feel that I can give access to, even if I've totally cocked something up. Go through a phase there, make sure that it's not absolutely terrible, and then we make that whole piece open, and then we just keep iterating through until we've got everything that needs to be done. Now, there's a few things in the wings that popped up since that meeting, which I think are really, really going to help move us in that direction. And my challenge again is just, finding the time, because this still is something that I have to do between all the other things that are going on in life. So, finding the time. B, trying to keep some momentum with it. And three, doing it in a way that also doesn't put the data of other people at risk. Now, a really big thing with this, and again, 99.99% of people, I think, understand this and are very happy, but the data breaches themselves are never going to be open source. Now, this is not any anti-open source thing or anything like that, but this is your personal data, my personal data. And yes, a lot of it you can go and grab from other places, but none of that puts me in a position where I either want to or feel legally safe to take this data and just go, here's the keys and here's every single piece of information. There's data in there that people have killed themselves over, Ashley Madison data. There's a huge amount of really sensitive stuff. Some of these websites are very, very much on the edge, if not over the edge, of the shady side of things, particularly some of the really, I'm trying to find the word that doesn't get me into trouble here. Some of the adult stuff that, all right, there's one there called Wife Lovers, which is, I didn't look into it in a lot of detail, honestly, because it was just got super weird. But I suspect that many of, it was basically like a photo to publish sexy, or a service to publish sexy pictures of your wife, air quotes. I'm not sure how much of that's consensual. There's probably a whole bunch of that, which is illegal in terms of the activity on the website. Now, I don't have all the images and things like that, and frankly, I'm quite happy not having that, but I have the data. Now, imagine all of that went public. And some person has a record in there, and then they are implicated as being involved in potentially illegal or nefarious activity. Now, maybe they created the record, maybe they didn't. But the whole reason of having things like is sensitive attributes on data breaches is to make sure that that stuff isn't actually visible. Point is that I'm not under any circumstances going to go and pick up all this person identifiable information and then just go and, yeah, open it all up. Like, that's absolutely nuts. I'm going to have a look at the comments. Just I want to take a little bit more of the coffee here. there's a question here. Why I'm up so early? I get up early. So I think part of it's a little bit of a cultural thing. Part of it's a little bit of a location thing here. So the Gold Coast, for those of you unaware, if you sort of picture Australia, Australia always looks like a little bit of a diamond. We're over on the very, very far right-hand side. We're in a state that doesn't have daylight saving. Now, apparently it's something to do with the cows being confused if we like wind the clocks back at some time of year. But it's quite weird because we've basically got three states right on top of each other. And Queensland, our state, is really that the sun is at the same position at the same time of day as the two states that are immediately beneath it, but we don't have daylight saving. Now, what that means is that when we get to summer and down in Sydney and Melbourne, it's getting dark at, say, 8 p.m., it's getting dark at 7 p.m. here. Conversely, it's getting light at, 6 a.m. in the southern states. It's 5 a.m. here. And I do find people tend to just run their days earlier. This is just my anecdotal observation after living in Sydney 15 years and then here for, I guess, a total of 10 years. It's also a very outdoorsy place. So, you can go down to the beach at 5 a.m. and there'll be a bunch of people walking their dogs or things like that. A lot of our cafes are open from 5:30 in the morning. So I usually don't have to set an alarm or anything, which is fine, but I just naturally wake up at 5:30-ish most of the time. But then I go to bed kind of early. Like, I'm always in bed before 10 o'clock, sometimes 9 o'clock. So it's just not that early for me. It's kind of normal. All right, looking at the other comments here. Does Have I Been Pwned have backups just in case the database gets corrupt or something? It does. But this is actually a really good example of where I want support to try and improve things. So Have I Been Pwned has table storage, Azure table storage, as the underlying data schema for the 10 billion plus records. Now, table storage was the best possible choice to get this thing up and running because it's super, super cheap. It's super, super fast. It scales like crazy. The only time I've ever seen any problems at all in terms of volume is when I'm doing massive data loads, which is hitting that underlying storage at a rate faster than what I'm ever going to see organic traffic. And I just realized as soon as I said that, someone's going to come along, or one day it's going to come along and I'm going to have organic traffic that smashes that. But there's no native backup strategy. I've literally got to run AZ copy, which is an Azure command to transfer things between table storage and blob storage, etc. I've literally got to run that on a VM on some sort of regular cadence and create a massive, massive JSON file of data. I then, of course, have all the original data that I could reload. It wouldn't be much fun. So there's that. That's one of the things that I really want the community to work on. And I started having some good discussions probably about 6 months ago with Microsoft about alternative schemas or alternative data structures. So that's the sort of thing which hopefully we can sort of pick up as part of this exercise and get something which is a little more sustainable. All right. So what else we got here? I've seen some YouTube creators claim that because Nord is registered in Panama, they don't keep logs. Is that something that could be addressed? So one of the things that I've put to Panama, Joe, I told you it's early. One of the things I've put to Nord is that I would like to see more clarity publicly about the jurisdictions. Now, there are good reasons for these decisions as well. Now, some of them are privacy-based reasons and some of them are business-based reasons. Now, I'm not going to speak on their behalf until I'm 100% clear of stuff I can say publicly about how they've structured it. But as an example, many organizations incorporate in places like Ireland because there are tax advantages. The Panama situation, I believe, does relate to privacy insofar as if, and again, not quite ignored here. So we're going to get proper details on this later on. But with something like a VPN, of course, you want to have confidence that information can remain private. And there's another rabbit hole we can go down about bad guys using VPNs and doing bad guy stuff and legal interception, and at what point do you actually hand over information. Another rabbit hole. But the point is that there have been decisions made on their behalf that are a combination of business structure and privacy. So I'd like to get some clear messaging out about that. What I will say is that I haven't seen anything to suggest that those business structures are there to do shady stuff. It's more about actually protecting the people that use the service. There's one VPN I trust not to keep logs, and it certainly isn't Nord. Well, you know, this is again, one of the reasons that I wanted the relationship, because there are some super shady VPNs. In fact, in the blog post I made last week, I had an embedded tweet of a news article of a whole bunch of VPNs that got owned recently, and a whole heap of their logs, when they said they didn't keep them, got exposed. I think we've got to be a bit careful too when we have this very, very binary position about logs. Do you have logs? Do you not have logs? As if it's like you have everything or you have nothing. I would imagine, and this is not a discussion that I've had with Nord yet, but I would imagine there has to be some record somewhere of, say, who is actually a customer, and when they authenticate, is this person still an active customer, and do we have some sort of even just stateless data which is collected as that authenticated session is going on? Is there any information about how long they've been using the service? I don't know. Now, my point is, I imagine there's going to be some pieces of data there, but what I did like about Nord is because you've got all of these VPN providers going, none of us keep logs, none of us keep logs. Now, obviously, some of them do. I liked the fact that Nord went and got those PwC audits this year and last year as well, and they had a Big Four accounting firm, which would have cost an absolute bomb to go and get as well, go through, independently audit the system, come out with findings and go, right, you guys are actually doing what you say. Now, I just like the idea of actually putting money where mouths are, because that would have been a very expensive exercise. Look, that's the sort of thing I want to talk more about in the future, because I think that the transparency that they're trying to give people is super, super important, and clearly there's a lot that aren't doing that. Okay, what else is in here? From Daniel, Nord's statement on why they're in Panama. NordVPN is based in Panama. This country has no mandatory data retention laws and does not participate in the Five Eyes or 14 Eyes alliances. So I tell you what I'll do. I'm definitely taking this as a note. In fact, it's already in my notes. I don't have to make another one about clarity around jurisdictions. Don't tidy the code too much, says Paul. Love to see real-world code, and the community will tidy it for you. Yeah, look, I mean, I don't care too much. Some of it's going to be shitty code. I think, to be honest, that the strength of Have I Been Pwned in terms of the bits that have been done really well is more the overall design of the table storage and the functions and the Cloudflare workers and things sitting on top of it. There's a whole bunch of code, particularly things like, I am not very good at my asyncs. I would love people to come along and do a much better job at the async work of some of the things that happen in the background of Have I Been Pwned, because it could be a lot more efficient than what it actually is. What else here? What is something tangible I can talk about? How do I find out about the free online talks you do? You know, if you want free online talks, and I'll actually put this as a link down here, troyhunt.com/recorded-talks has all my recorded talks. And then in terms of the free ones, look, anything I do that is public, and the ones that are public are almost always free anyway. I tweet them and I share them out. I just actually look at my upcoming events panel on my blog, which doesn't look very healthy at the moment. So I probably need to tweak that a little bit. All right, what else is here? Christian Anderson, you've worked hard to put the data in there. Don't open source that data. You've also protected access to the data on the site, so it makes sense you do not open it up. Yep, I agree with you there. I think we're on the same page with that. Burton, can you publish pwned passwords? Yeah, the code for that, absolutely. In fact, that's a good example of something which is very sort of something that I can pick up and just go, yoink, here's the thing. Like, let's just take pwned passwords on its own And, you know, look, there's going to be nothing at all surprising in there. And in fact, what I've got to figure out as well is things like a lot of the work in Pwn Passwords is actually in the Cloudflare worker. So I've got to have a chat with Janard from Cloudflare and go, mate, how about we get this? We chuck it in a repo somewhere and we make it available to people. But, you know, then taking contributions and things on that, that then has flow-on effects to his workflow and how we do deployments and things like that. So, but yeah, but good point. I can definitely do that, Burton. Fuzzy says there will be logs. Good VPN providers should specify what they log, though. Yep, absolutely. Proton VPN, for example, says exactly what they log. Yep, I think that's very fair. I haven't looked to see if Nord are doing that or not, but I'll point at that. A VPN that keeps no logs should be perfect for criminals that want to hide their activity. So here's the problem. And this is obviously not just a Nord issue. This is, you know, even an HTTPS issue. It's an end-to-end encryption issue. The problem is that encryption is morally neutral. Technology is morally neutral. So we've got this challenge where we're saying we want to give people the right to privacy and anonymity and all this sort of thing. And there are many good reasons to have that. That might be anything from me wanting to, you know, let's say I'm, hypothetically, I don't think this is true, but you know, let's say I'm worried I'm suffering from depression and I want to go onto a website and I want to read all about depression. I don't want to share that with my ISP. I don't want anything from my connections through to depression.com.au or my DNS queries or anything like that being visible to them. I want anonymity for that. I want my privacy. Now, the problem is that the bloke planning on blowing stuff up is pretty much in the same boat because he wants privacy and anonymity and everything else. And the challenge that we always come back to is how do we make sure that people have the right to privacy and anonymity as a basic human right, but also we make sure that we protect the society. So this is where a lot of the discussion has been in recent years around lawful interception, how law enforcement deals with end-to-end encryption, what role tech companies play with it as well. It's a tricky situation. It's an absolute tricky situation. But the point here about a VPN keeping no log should be perfect for criminals. Well, it's kind of perfect for political activists, journalists, people with personal interests or things that they don't want to share with others that may be perfectly legal. Juan, am I still using Freedom as your VPN? No, not at the moment because I've got Nord. James says, have you found any developer-friendly controller from code IoT devices when setting up the smart home IoT device in your house? I'm going to talk a lot about IoT later on because we're going to get to, in fact, it was pretty much the last thing that's going to be on this list because it was something that is a rabbit hole I went down even deeper yesterday. Literally got this sitting on my desk. All right, so I'm just flicking through it in here. Fozzie's made a point here about DNS over HTTPS. I think I need to write something on that at some point just to clarify what's seen and what's not seen and by whom as well. Because you then go on, Fozzie, make the point, the domain name is still in the SNI of the client, hello, TLS, handshake, even if you use DOH. And, of course, the handshake is over. It's port 443, but it is visible over HTTP. And then there's ESNI and all the rest of it. Another rabbit hole. Right. So going back to tweets and things like this for over the last 6 days. So just looking through at what was relevant here, I made a funny comment here just about how, well, I thought it was funny anyway, about how fickle the internet is. So I remember where I was when I tweeted this. I was down at my local coffee shop waiting for my coffee and I'm just like flicking through my tweets. And there's a guy here who's quote tweeted my tweet about open sourcing, Have I Been Pwned? And the guy says, Troy Hunt is a gentleman. He's been a legend for some time. Now he's immortal. Now, this is a very nice tweet, right? I liked it. And then immediately under this, someone says, in response to my Nord thing, well, there goes any credibility you might have had. It's like, this is just so internet where you're constantly lifted up and smashed down, and there's just this constant toying of ups and downs and emotions. So, you know, good on that guy for being a dick. Also, what's with the term any credibility you might have had? Not saying you did have any, you might have. You just don't have any anymore. I feel like I should do a mean tweet reading one time. Holy crap. I'll tell you what, that's going to be an X-rated session, which should be interesting. And then I got a whole bunch of tweets all around the the bits with Nord. Now, one thing I did this week is a bit of hard disk drive buying. So I bought another 2 10-terabyte Western Digital Red drives. The Western Digital Red are the drives that are meant to be more NAS-orientated drives. So I did expand my network attached storage this week. Synology sent me over a DS920. So I've had a DS1512. I think I went back through my tweets and figured out it was like 8 years. And I've upgraded disks over the years, and that drive has supported all sorts of different things, everything from running Plex through to storing heaps and heaps of data. And they, because some people think I'm nice on the internet, not everyone, they sent me the 920. So I had this extra enclosure, and I went, oh, okay, this will be another, you know, way for me to sort of segment some of the different things I do. So looking at disk drives, I went and got the 2 10-terabytes. Now, people are saying, why didn't you go and get like 14-terabyte drives? And I kind of made the point in here, like at the moment, at least in Australia with our pricing model here, 10 terabytes is the absolute sweet spot, certainly for Western Digital Reds, of price versus performance. So it's basically like that the cost per megabyte, gigabyte, terabyte is pretty much the same at like 6, 8, 10. And then you get to 12 and 14 and the cost per terabyte really starts to skyrocket. So that was just a sweet spot. I've never had a WD Red fail. Now, that's personal experience. A bunch of other people said the same thing. A couple of people chimed in and went, everyone I've had has failed. So yeah, make of that what you will, but they have been super reliable. And I did actually rotate them around. So I did have a 10 terabyte in the old device. I took the 10 terabyte out, which I can do because it runs Synology Hybrid RAID. So it's got one disk fault tolerance. So everything kept running, but it's like, you just have no fault tolerance. And I took one of the new ones and I put it in to the old NAS. Everything replicated, took about 24 hours, but replicated at that time, it would have been, I don't know, 8 terabytes or something worth of data to the other disk. So now I've got like one older 10 terabyte disk and one new one, and I put them in the new machine. And the reason for this is that I don't want to have two brand new drives, possibly from the same batch, from the same run, from the same shop, and put them into a device to be fully redundant, because what if they both have the same flaw? Now, maybe you could have the same flaw on the older drive, which had already been in there running for 18 months or something like that as well, but you know, less likely. So expanded out the whole Synology bit here. Now, I'm just going to have a look at these comments, and I am going to skip past any of the old stuff which we've already covered. In question here, I'm assuming you use 2FA for your emails and websites, SMS-based or authenticator-based. So I've written a blog post. I'm going to drop in comments about 2FA, blog post for everything. And there is an absolute hierarchy of 2FA, which basically goes, worst case, no 2FA. Better than that, SMS 2FA. Better than that, authenticator app 2FA, so effectively soft tokens. Better than that, hard token 2FA. Now, incidentally, all the 2FAs up until that point are all fishable as well, because they all rely on someone relaying something which they observe, namely a PIN, either a PIN that comes in on an SMS or a PIN that comes in via your authenticator app or your hard token. So they do have vulnerability there. And if you go all the way up the 2FA ecosystem, you end up with U2F, so universal two-factor authentication, which is a physical key that can't be phished, which has to be inserted or NFC'd or Bluetooth to a device. So I turn on 2FA on absolutely everything, and I try and do it in that order. If I can use just U2F, for example, Google Advanced Protection, which is in the link I just sent, that's what I'm going to use. If I can't use that, I actually don't have any hard tokens anymore because they're a pain in the ass, but I'll use a soft token. If I can't use that, I will use SMS. So I definitely 2FA, all of the things that I possibly can. Someone here doesn't like red drives. I told you some people love it, some people hate it. And the thing is, like, everyone has an opinion, and they'll go, you should go and use, instead of the Western Digital, it'll be the Corsair this or the IBM that, or it'll be something else. And that's good, it works for you, but I would like to... Oh, all that noise is out there. I would like to keep my existing run of my good luck with WD Reds. So let's move on past that. Someone says you need the WD Red Plus. Ben Davis, mean tweets would be a great session to do with Scott Helm. Oh, I know what I should do. I should just read mean tweets about Scott Helm. That would be even more fun. we do have fun. Maybe we should do another session. So we did a Cyberbroken session, which is basically, well, it ended up being like 3 hours worth of taking the piss out of cyber and each other at the start of COVID lockdown. So maybe we should do that again. Okay. What else is in here? How much data is on the drives? Lots. Oh, shit, it's Scott. I didn't see. It's funny because Scott always pops up with a little spanner next to his name. I was going to say something mean about that. But many years ago, I did Have I Been Pwned birthday thing. And I made him an administrator so that he could keep people at bay. See, and he still has that. Use the power wisely. Fozzie, you can fish a security key, just send it in the mail. Yeah, it is a harder exercise. It is a harder exercise, admittedly. All right, so moving on. So the Synology NAS got a good update. A few new spams during the week. So I have been tweeting the link to my blog post about not liking spammy articles. So every time someone sends me an email and they're like, hey, I was reading your blog post on blah, I thought you'd like to link through to my story on blah, blah, it would be really helpful to your users. It's just outright spam. So I have been taking the title of their thing and I have been putting that in my blog post about spam and then tweeting the title of their thing with a blog post to mine, or a link rather, to my blog post about spam. And then I just send them back just the URL. No words. It's like I just reply URL. Now, I do find this entertaining, if I'm honest, particularly seeing the replies that come back when these organizations try to justify what they're doing. And it is normally organizations that are just basically like link farming stuff out. I'm sure it's like lowly paid people sitting there in cheap markets who then use a stock photo to put in their profile so that they look like someone responsible. And then they make up a name that just sounds very generic and they go, hey, link to my thing. Now, the fun thing about this is that I'm getting good SEO on this. So the search terms, or rather the titles of their posts, which I'm tweeting here, when I do this, so for example, the one I'm seeing here is the best internet tools for distance learning. The fun thing now is that if I was to go, and that might even be a bit of a generic one, but if I was to Google the best internet tools for, gotta spell it right, for distance learning like this, one of the top results is my tweet, which is awesome. Now, I am logged onto Google as myself as well, so it might be doing a little bit of prioritization there. But when I have tested this, go out on 4G incognito mode, it's also still been doing well. So I have been getting a lot of entertainment out of that, which is good. Now, what else is in here that is commentable? Is there any known weaknesses of Microsoft Authenticator? Not that I know of. Not that I know of. That's all I can really say. All right. So, there's a comment here. Thanks for your help sharing awareness about Namecheap's actions. Care to comment? I made some comments about Namecheap recently. Now, I realized as I was making those comments that I'd actually made other comments about Namecheap recently as well. Recently, over the years. If I look for Troy Hunt, what did I actually say? What was the thing the other day? It was something shady. Oh, this is right. They were okay. So here's my tweet. I have quote tweeted someone here. Oliver Hugh Howe says, Oliver says, yet another battle lost with hosts that just don't seem to care. So basically, from memory, Namecheap was hosting a phishing site, and they had a whole bunch of credentials and things sitting there on the phishing site. And this was hosted on their platform and they just weren't doing anything to take it down. And they had a response to Oliver along the lines of, we have thoroughly investigated your allegation to the extent of our capabilities, but we're unable to validate your claims. And Oliver is literally like, dude, there's a whole list of credentials here, which are clearly collected via phishing. And I kind of made the point here, ever wonder why phishing sites and breached credentials stay online? Read Oliver's experience with Namecheap. And he goes through a whole thread here of stuff that he tried to do to fix this. So I'll just drop this in the comments. And it was a little bit of a painful experience. And I'd had issues with Namecheap before, mostly around misrepresenting TLS, HTTPS certificates. So I just get the impression that this is one of these organizations where the marketing droids seem to be in control, at least with the communications with people on Twitter. So that wasn't a good look for them, if I'm honest. So there was that. Now, what else is down here? All right, back on the tweet thread. What else has been happening this week? Oh, I'm running at 125 days of closed exercise rings on this, which is good, closing everything. So, I mean, yesterday, I'll put my phone. Yesterday, day before, was a great example. So one of the nice things about COVID, and I appreciate how somewhat obnoxious that sounds as well, but the nice things about just being consistently in one place is just being able to get routine. So like Wednesday, 4.27 kilometer walk in the morning, and then a 2 kilometer bike ride, because I went back to the coffee shop to have a coffee with a mate, then a 1.5 kilometer bike ride, then 1,300 something kilojoules, because I played tennis for an hour, and then just over 3K bike ride home. So it has been really good for that. COVID has been really good for just sort of getting out there and being active, which is nice. Now, screws. Let's talk about screws, because this actually really smashed my timeline. So I have been doing some things around the house, and for reasons unbeknownst to me, and it had been here since I moved in nearly 5 years ago, there was a security door on the inside of the house. So there's a bit between the lounge room and the garage. Scott's been here. He knows what I'm talking about. Bit between the lounge room and the garage where there is a normal solid door with a deadlock on it. And there was a security door in front of that on the inside. So you had to, like, if you're in the lounge room to go to the garage, you had to open the security door to then go through the solid door into the garage. So every time you just want to go into the garage, either to go to the network cabinet that's in there or get a beer or get the car, had to open the security door. And it had like a big black fly screen on an otherwise white wall. And we're doing some renos and things at the moment. And it just didn't fit. So I'm like, that's cool. I got a drill with a screw bit. I'll just take the door off. And then it's got this super, super weird pattern on it. And I was sort of looking at it close, and it's like a Torx, but it's not a Torx. So it's a 5-lobe screw pattern with a center pin. And when I looked at it really, really closely, it was unidirectional. So it's meant to be tamper-proof. So you can screw it up, but then the way the lobes sweep, you can't unscrew it. So I was asking people, how do you get this off? Holy shit, there were some opinions on that. Like, it went way down the rabbit hole of ideas. And everyone's like, oh, well, you just go to Bunnings, like a local hardware store, and you get a security screw. No, you don't, because it doesn't actually match any of those. And the answer eventually was, this is from a company called CrimSafe, and CrimSafe make security doors, which I've heard their ads for years and years and years, and they pride themselves on the security of their doors. And authorized fitters have the drill bit. Well, it's not a drill bit, but effectively the screwdriver bit, which looks like a Torx. It fits that. So eventually I just had to call a guy up, and he came around, and it was literally a 3-minute job with the correct bit. And all the screws came off without destruction, which is good, because apparently the door is worth like $1,000 as well. So I'm going to try and find someone who wants to buy an undamaged security door now. But it was quite fascinating looking at security people answer the question. And then there are a few points where people chimed in. It's like, you can tell who's not a physical penetration tester. Now, that's not just me, but it was all the people going, oh, all you do is you go and get this, you know, this particular bit and put that in and it's going to be fine. Most of the responses boiled down to things like the practical responses, but they were destruction responses, is doing things like trying to get a flathead screwdriver in between the lobes and undo that. But there were about 14 screws or something, so it would not have been fun. Or trying to effectively file a straight channel through the middle, and then you can fit a flathead screwdriver or a chisel or something in there to undo it. Best option ever, you find someone with the right bit and they just undo the whole thing. All right, question here from Richard Troy. Did you know we were hunting for kangaroo? That's the weirdest spelling of kangaroo ever. In Norway, which had run from the zoo here in Norway. So for a week, we did have a kangaroo in the wild in Norway. Well, I feel sorry for the kangaroo. Was it snowy as well? But mind you, we do have kangaroos in the snow here. Nowhere near here, but sometimes we do. All right, so there was that. Now, other things that were interesting this week, being conscious of time as well, because I do want to go. In fact, part of the reason I'm doing this super early is it's a public holiday here today. It is the Gold Coast or Queensland show day, where normally you would go to a show, you know, like a fair with rides and horses and things like this, but not in the COVID era, but that doesn't stop the kids from having a public holiday. All right, so two more things that come to mind. So one of them, is I'm after another universal remote control. I've had a Logitech Harmony for a while. It was one of the good Logitech Harmonies with like the hub, and the remote talks to the hub. The hub also connects over Wi-Fi. There's a companion app, and it's got two external IR blasters you can put near units which require IR. Now, I have been constantly having problems with the Harmony being unable to reach the hub, even when it's close by, and frankly, just not having a good, reliable connection. So I've just been asking people, like, what's a good recommendation for a universal remote? I think, honestly, the Harmony stuff is, like, it's good at the price for given how much you use a universal remote and how many years it will last, i.e. I'd like it to last a good 5 years plus. I'm happy to spend a bit of money on it, but it's just really hard to find something that's decent, that's well-made, and that you can actually manage yourself. So there's a brand called Control 4, and they're a beautiful remote. And I was in the home theater place here the other day, and I was picking this up. I was like, this is awesome. And I was like, I've got to get one of these. And they're like, yeah, we can program it for you. So no, I'm fine. Like, I've done code before. And they're like, no, like, we actually have to do it for you. You know, you cannot get access to it yourself. I was like, well, that's killed that. And it was kind of funny too, and this will actually lead me through the last thing I want to talk about, because they said this can be the hub for all of the control of all your IoT things. And I'm like, oh, my God, like, that's on top of Google Home and Amazon Alexa and HomeKit and all the other stuff. Like, there's all of these things that want to be the hub. And, of course, the thing that is my hub now and the hub for many people building out IoT stuff themselves is Home Assistant. So I've spent a lot of time with Home Assistant over the last couple of months, especially over the last week, just building stuff out. So everything that is connected in here, so for example, the Stream Deck, which controls my lights, that is a Home Assistant action. And that's calling a webhook, which then turns on an automation, which turns on lights and things. The units I got just here are a good example of where it all starts to go downhill. So I had the Sparky in here yesterday. Now, I've since learned that not everyone says Sparky, which is an electrician in Australia. So he was in here as part of the renovation stuff that we are doing to fit some lights and bang some holes in walls. I'm going to show everyone when I'm done, once it's all done. And he said, give these a go, because the lights up here in my office are halogen and they were having some real problems. Fun fact, I've got 135, I think, different halogen lights around the house, which is an absolute pain in the ass because they burn really hot, they use a heap of power, and they often fail. And there are places in the house where they've got really high ceilings, so think probably about 4 or 5 meters, no, it's more than that, 6, 7, 8 meters, which I just simply can't reach, and I have to get someone out with a massive ladder. Pain in the ass. So he said, give these a go. Now, these are Atom units, and I think Atom is an Aussie brand, so you may not have heard of somewhere else, that are Wiz connected. Now, I'd already learned that Wiz connected, although it can integrate with Google Assistant, Amazon Alexa, Siri, so HomeKit, and if this, then that, doesn't have any integrations for Home Assistant, as best I can tell. I'd love for someone to prove me wrong. So short of actually trying to use one of those other integrations to then somehow pair back to Home Assistant, these are kind of nice, but I can't do anything with them. Anyway, the bigger discussion, and if people have got comments on this, I'd love to hear it as well, is that, say, for these lights, now I've got two of them. Fortunately, there's like two directly above me, and then there's two, which are still the old halogens pointing down at the back wall. But two of these in the roof, they're on the main switch, which is fine. I've set them up in the Wiz app so I can control the color and the turn them on and off and the brightness and everything in the Wiz app, which is great. The problem is, and there's a load of discussion about this on the thread I started yesterday, is that if I turn the power off at the wall, there's no power going to the IoT things in the light. So I literally cannot use the app. I cannot use an automation to turn them on when I come into the room. If I leave the switch on the wall on, I can use all the soft things, so the app and automation, whatever else, now that's an automation. Once I can figure out how to get into Home Assistant, then I can turn it on and off using the soft things, but then if I go and turn it off at the power switch, all that might do is it's been turned off digitally, and then I turn it off again, and it's like, why won't it go off? And then I turn it back on, and it's like, well, it's already off because now I have to go back. The point is, I don't want a situation in a house where people actually need to live where they don't necessarily know all the IoT configuration, I don't want a situation where you can't use a freaking light switch, because this is the simplest circuit anywhere, right? A light switch, it's on or it's off. It should still work. Now, a bunch of people have said, okay, well, what you should be doing is you should be using IoT switches themselves. So forget about making the lights IoT, unless you want to control color and stuff like that. Make the switches IoT. And heaps of people are like, just go and get Shelly units, for example, and install them yourself. Multiple problems here. So number one is that Australia does have some pretty strict guidelines around things needing to be compliant with standards, which I can't remember the name of. I can't just go onto like eBay, get something, and literally wire it into the circuitry of the house. It will not be compliant. If my house burns down, I'm going to have a real problem here. First problem there. Second problem is that you must legally have a physical isolation switch on each circuit. So, and that has to be somewhere where you can go and literally see that the light's been turned off. So Spark, who's making the point to me, said, mate, if you don't have a switch on the wall and someone goes up and they like take the light bulb out, or they cut the end off the wire and the thing's still live, you've got major issues. So what I'm trying to figure out is how do we get that sweet spot? Because in the entertainment room where we're doing the reno work at the moment, I want to have physical switches, but I want to be able to have automation on them as well. So I'm looking at some of the Lutron stuff that people have sent through, but if anyone has found a good solution which does allow for a physical isolation switch on the wall, which can be like a push button one, so it doesn't have to indicate on off state by being like that or, you know, whatever it is. If anyone's found a good solution for those, let me know, but I don't want it to feel like someone's cobbled together a bunch of IoT shit in the house. Like that's the big thing for me. I want it to feel like a nice, clean, integrated house with a light switch that works like any other light switch, yet I can still use it on my phone and, most importantly, with Home Assistant. All right, so let me get off my high horse nut for a moment. So let me see if there's any other comments around this now. Nothing of any substance from Scott, that's for sure. Did you set up a sensor for the light? So what I do have in my office, and I haven't actually mounted it anywhere yet, is I've got a little Akera. Xiaomi Akera, I think Akera is the right pronunciation. Let's just assume it is. Motion and light sensor. And I've got an automation on this. In fact, I've got two automations on this. So one automation says if the light is below a certain level, so i.e. I don't have the blinds open and there's like daylight streaming in and there's motion, then turn on the three neons. So there's two Philips Hue Go's and there's a Philips Hue light strip under the desk. And then if there's no movement for 10 minutes, turn it off. So I've got that in here. I've got to decide as I start building more stuff out if I want to integrate it with ceiling lights and things like that. But I got that there. I've got one in each of the kids' rooms, and I've got a lot of neon in the kids' rooms now. So when they walk into the rooms, like the neon comes on, there's an Amazon Alexa, an Echo Dot, rather, in each room, and the Echo Dot talks to them and welcomes them with the text-to-speech routine, which is kind of cool. So I'll do a bit more of that. Sparky sounds like what happens when you get a bad electrician. Well, it can do. Now, I've noticed here, Christian, you've said Home Assistant, if this, then that, whiz. The problem is once you depend on if this, then that, then you're dependent on a cloud service to be able to turn on your freaking light. And I don't want to have that. I mean, part of the joy of Home Assistant is a Raspberry Pi that sits here in the server cabinet. And if all the power to everything else goes, I can still use the house in the way the house is meant to work. Actually, I'll rephrase it. Not if the power to everything goes, then I've got no lights anyway. If the internet connection goes. So I do want to be able to turn on my lights without needing the internet to be working. Make the light switch Bluetooth. I'm not sure if that really helps at all. Christian says, get physical switch near the lamp on the roof, which no one can literally reach unless they do changes. That's a mess too. Like, we're sort of doing some really nice renos and things here at the moment, and I don't want a situation where I've got to put switches and things in funny places. I'm sure there are solutions to this. I just got to think it through properly. But I think where my mind just started reaching an impasse was you've got a physical switch on the wall. When the physical switch is off, you're literally killing power to the circuit. If you've got an IoT thing that's sitting there in the circuit, the IoT thing no longer has power. So how can you turn things on or off? But I know that there is a way of doing this, and my mind's just not joining the dots at this early hour. So I will find ways to do this, and I will share it. But part of the challenge as well is that when you're when you're sort of making changes to rooms, and this is involving plaster and wallpaper and other lights and things like this as well, when you're making changes like that, you are making changes for the long term too. Like I don't want to be changing the room again, for argument's sake, for the next 5 years, yet I'm putting in today's current gen technology and I'm dependent on things like if this and that. And as the Sparky said yesterday, he said, mate, if ever you leave the house, you want someone to come in and be able to use the house. You know, you don't want to go, okay, here's the keys, now let me walk you through the IoT automation sequence in order to use the freaking house. So I don't want it to become some sort of, you know, geeked out tech nerd center with shit just doesn't work unless you have the right app or the watch or something like that. It's still got to be a normal usable house. And then all of this adds rather than replaces. Rutger, what's your wife's opinion about all the tech at home automation? There are many ways of answering that question, which we might take up another time, actually. Shane says, I've had to add a lock room variable for motion-based events so I can force them to stay on or off in cases where I want to be moving enough to keep the lights on. So, I mean, I'm trying to figure out which comment Scott's laughing at. I think I know what he's laughing at. This is one of these things where you end up with sort of all these edge cases. I mean, the kids' room and the automations there is a good example. Like I want neon stuff to come on when there's movement in the room and then go off when there's not. But my son likes to keep his neon on when he sleeps. So it can't go off after his bedtime. But also, what if one night he doesn't want to have it on when he sleeps, it can't come on. So there has to be conditions around what hours of the day it actually comes on or off. So anyway, look, as I progress and as I find solutions for this, and it is a very, very slow progression, but hey, I got time, I will share that in blog post format. I do keep adding to a blog post about just sort of the fundamental components to get IoT working reliably in a human usable fashion. So I keep dropping a lot of stuff in there. I still haven't actually connected the garage doors, which was the whole point. I started going down this rabbit hole in the first place. But I think I'm close to that. I need to carve out maybe just half a day to play with it next week. So thank you very much for watching. I am going to go and start my day here. And when I do this next week, I'll do it at the other end of the day, which I guess will probably be about 11, 12 hours from this time on Friday next week. So thanks for watching. Hope you have an awesome day wherever you are. See you, folks.